we've invited Bill Gary to come and sort of give us the flip side of what we had last Thursday, or maybe last Tuesday. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2004. And Bill, if you'd come up, and then we've got a list of several folks who'd like to testify on the mortality tables.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Bill Gary. I'm an attorney practicing with the law firm of Harang Long, Gary Rudnick. And most recent involvement with the Public Employees Retirement System has been as legal counsel on behalf of the petitioning cities in the City of Eugene et al. Case that led to the Lipscomb decision last fall. I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee on the subject of actuarial equivalency factors, and in particular the subject of contract rights of PERS members and how those rights may be affected by a bill such as House Bill 2004 that directs the PERS Board to implement current and updated mortality tables. I've had the opportunity to review the testimony, the written submission that was presented to you by Mr. Hartman last week, and I have prepared and submitted to you a letter that I hope is responsive to the arguments that you heard last week. What I'd like to begin by stating an area of agreement with Mr. Hartman, and that is that it is undisputably true that the Oregon Supreme Court has recognized that there are contract rights that arise by virtue of the PERS statutes. No one disputes that. And I think it is also undisputedly true that any action that the Legislative Assembly takes that results in meaningful reform of the PERS system and produces recognizable, identifiable savings in the projected costs of the system will be challenged in court by someone who claims that that action constitutes a breach of contract. If the committee is looking for the silver bullet that will solve the problem without being attacked as a breach of contract, then I suggest that it is going to be a difficult task indeed. There are no silver bullets here. But the fact that someone can claim that an action of the legislature constitutes a breach of contract does not make it so. And so the real appropriate inquiry is not, is somebody going to claim that this breaches a contract, but does it in fact constitute a breach of contract or an impairment of the obligation of contract? And in order to answer that question, it is not enough to simply say the PERS statutes constitute a contract, and so anything we do to change the contracts that has the effect of reducing anticipated future benefits will breach the contract, because that is not the law. The Supreme Court has recognized that some provisions of the PERS statutes are contractual promises to PERS members. It's important to note, not all provisions in the PERS statutes are contractual promises. Only some of them are. Some of them have been identified by the court in specific challenges as constituting contractual promises. You're all familiar with the case that arose out of the legislature's decision to tax benefits, and the court held that the promise that the benefits would not be taxed by the state was a contractual promise. And so in order to determine whether any particular provision of the statutes is a contractual promise, the first question that one must ask is that statute a part of the body of promises that the legislature has made to PERS members? And the court has given us a pretty good indication of how you go about making that determination. You look at what the legislature intended. If the legislature if the evidence, the legislative history, clearly demonstrates a legislative intent to make a contractual statutory promise to PERS members, then it will be treated as a contract. So it is a question of what this body intended when it enacted the law. Two important points as they bear on mortality tables in that regard. Number one, the court has only held that the legislature can and has made statutory contractual promises. No court in Oregon has ever held that any action by the PERS board constitutes a contract. It is the legislature that makes the contract because it's the legislature that decides what the terms of the PERS agreement will be. And the second point is that when you begin looking at any particular proposal, it's important for House Bill 2004, but it will be important for all of this committee's work, and you are confronted with the suggestion that you've heard that there is a breach of contract if you enact the bill, the first question that you must ask in answer is, what is the promise that is being breached? What promise did the legislature intentionally make that would be breached by this legislative act? Now, in the case of House Bill 2004 and the implementation of accurate and current mortality tables, the fact of the matter is that there is nothing that appears in the statutes, anywhere in the statutes, that remotely suggests that the legislature ever intended to make a statutory contractual promise that the PERS board would calculate benefits by using inaccurate and outdated mortality tables. Quite the contrary. ORS 238.300, subsection 1, is the relevant statute here. That's the statute that describes how the PERS is to go about calculating a retirement benefit. Now, for many people who retire under a full formula benefit, their benefit is determined ultimately by multiplying the years of service times their final average salary times the 1.67% or 2% in the case of police and fire. And in that case, an actuarial calculation in the determination of the core benefit isn't even involved. The use of actuarial calculations in the initial calculation of the benefit comes into play when you're dealing with the money match benefit. The money match benefit says that a member will receive the benefit equal to the money that is in their account and interest that has been credited on their contributions times two, that the employer will match that contribution. And if you look at the language in ORS 238.300 sub 1, the language of the statute says that the benefit that a member will receive shall be, quote, the actuarial equivalent of accumulated contributions by the member and interest credited thereon at the time of retirement. What is involved in this is taking a lump sum of money and calculating what is an equal monthly benefit for the rest of that member's life. That's what actuarial equivalence means. If you've got $100,000 in cash, that is equal to a certain amount of money paid each month over the expected life of the member. That's what the statute provides. If there is a contractual promise relating to actuarial calculations, the promise is that a member will receive the actuarial equivalent of the accumulated contributions and interest credited thereon. There is no other promise that can be found in the statutes. Now, how does that compare with what the PERS board does? For the past several years, the PERS board has used outdated mortality factors, factors that for the most part are traceable to 1978, to determine what the monthly benefit will be. And the problem with that is, as we all know, on average, people are living longer today than they were living in 1978, about 4 years longer overall. What that means is that if you apply outdated mortality factors, it will produce a monthly benefit that will exhaust the accumulated contributions 4 years earlier on average than the member's life expectancy. And so after the 1978 life expectancy is surpassed, the taxpayer is required to continue paying the same benefit for as long as that member lives. And unlike the situation during the 1978 life expectancy, where the member's account pays for half the benefit and the employer pays for half the benefit, for any time that the member lives past their 1978 life expectancy, the taxpayers pay 100% of the bill. That's why this is significant. And it does produce a lower monthly benefit if you apply current actuarial tables, because you are spreading out the available money, the pool of money, over a longer period of time. That's the way it works, pure and simple. Is there a contractual right to have the benefit calculated using outdated mortality tables? And by the way, there isn't any dispute that these tables are outdated. Per his own actuary, Mr. Johnson first brought to the board's attention the fact that they were using outdated mortality tables. He testified in the case in Marion County before Judge Lipscomb that it was his opinion that the use of the mortality tables currently being used by the board does not produce a monthly benefit that is the actuarial equivalent of the accumulated contribution of the members and interest credited thereon at the time of retirement. And so it's undisputed that the tables that are being used produces a benefit that is higher than the statute provides. And the only way that one could conclude that doing so was a contractual obligation is if one concludes that the PERS board's decision not to update mortality tables constitutes itself a promise that is enforceable by the members. But the problem with that, other than the fact that no court has ever held that PERS has the ability to make contractual promises, their job is to implement this body's contractual promises. Apart from that fact, the case law is pretty clear that if a agency makes promises in excess of their statutory authority, those promises are unenforceable. They are unenforceable because people who deal with state agencies are charged with knowledge of the law that the agency enforces. Otherwise, statutes passed by this body could be disregarded by agencies, and they could create obligations on the part of the state in derogation of the statutes. And the law doesn't permit that. So again, you have to find something in the statutes that constitutes a promise to use outdated mortality tables in calculating the benefits. Now, Mr. Hartman and I have been jousting over PERS for a number of years, and I have high regard for Mr. Hartman. He does an excellent job of advocating for his clients. I respectfully submit that on this one, he's just plain wrong. We'll undoubtedly have other occasions to disagree before you with regard to the extent of contract rights, but with regard to contract rights as they apply to actuarial tables, Mr. Hartman is not only unsupported in the law is flatly against him. This issue was raised and decided by Judge Lipscomb in the lawsuit that we tried last summer. And it was after a two-week trial that Judge Lipscomb, in his opinion, wrote as follows. It is the conclusion of this court that the board has acted improperly in refusing to update its mortality tables and has abused its discretion in failing to follow the legislative mandate to maintain actuarial equivalency. when determining retirement benefits. None of the justifications and rationalizations offered by the board are sufficient to excuse the board's persistent refusal to implement this part of the statutory scheme, except when it would benefit employees. Neither fear of litigation by employees nor a concern for a potential challenge by the Internal Revenue Service is a sufficient basis for ignoring the board's own statutory obligations as established by the legislature. The board has a duty to comply with the statutory mandate immediately and fully. That's what Judge Lipscomb ruled. Now, interestingly, in the trial, although there was ample opportunity to do so, neither the interveners, who were represented by Mr. Hartman, nor the state, represented by the Attorney General's office, ever said to Judge Lipscomb, "Wait a minute, Judge, if you immediately and fully implement mortality tables, it will breach contract rights." That argument was never made. Now, there's legal significance to the fact that that argument was never made, because under the rules that we play by, if you don't make an argument in the trial court, you're precluded from attacking the judge's decision on appeal making that argument. So the state and the interveners will be foreclosed, if there is an appeal of Judge Lipscomb's decision, from talking about contract rights with respect to mortality tables. But I think that the more significant fact for your purposes is that the argument that you heard about how the application of current mortality tables would violate contract rights is an argument that neither the Attorney General nor the interveners thought was appropriate to make before the judge, who was deciding whether to order the PERS board to immediately enforce current actuarial tables. And I invite you to ask yourselves why it is that an argument of such weight in a hotly contested case by extremely competent counsel was never even on the stage before Judge Lipscomb. I submit to you that the reason that it wasn't an argument that was made was because it is an argument that has no merit. Now, I just want to mention one other thing, and then I'll be happy to respond to any questions that you have. There has been, two other things. There's been reference in Mr. Hartman's written materials to decisions from other cases, from other states, particularly Alaska and New York. And one of the things that you will discover if you take the time to read the briefs and get intimately familiar with all the legal arguments is that when it comes to pension law and deciding what the law is with regard to any particular pension system, it's very important that you make sure that you're dealing with apples and apples. The Alaska Supreme Court interpreting the Alaska pension system and saying that contract rights arise under the Alaska pension system is not very useful unless the Alaska pension system is in every respect identical, in relevant respects, identical to the PERS system. And the PERS system, as you all know, is a hybrid that is pretty unusual. As it happens, in both Alaska and New York, where those decisions came from, there are provisions in the state constitutions that specifically say that benefits may not be reduced under any circumstances. There is no corollary provision in the Oregon Constitution. And so the rationale for those decisions is really inapplicable. We could cite you cases from other states, including Washington, that go the other way, but they're about as useful as the decisions cited to you by Mr. Hartman. The relevant cases that you need to look at are the decisions of our own courts, and obviously the most applicable one in this instance is the decision by Judge Lipscomb. And lastly, I want to preface my last remark with a disclaimer, and that is I am not a tax lawyer, nor am I an ERISA lawyer, nor am I qualified to render an opinion concerning IRC regulations, that is the Internal Revenue Code. There's been a suggestion made that updating mortality tables and applying current mortality tables to member benefits would jeopardize the TAC-qualified status of the public employees' retirement system. I just want to point out to you that and this is based upon advice from my partner, Wally Miller, who is a tax lawyer and an ERISA lawyer and is qualified to render the opinion. The Internal Revenue Code section that is cited by Mr. Hartman as being potentially a problem is expressly by statute and in a private letter IRS ruling inapplicable to government pension plans. There is not a problem with the Internal Revenue Code with respect to the implementation of mortality tables. Does that mean that you should adopt the bill? No. That's a policy judgment, obviously, that you have to make, and there are many different factors that you have to balance. But in our opinion, it does mean that on this point, there is not a colorable argument that directing the PERS board to do what the law has always required it to do and to immediately implement mortality tables would constitute a breach of contract or impair the obligation of contract. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson and then Representative Nolan.
Mr. Gary, under your view of contract rights, does the board's practice of using an out-of-date set of mortality tables become binding at any point with respect to a member?
Representative McPherson, as a matter of contract, I don't believe so. I think if the PERS board calculates benefits that exceed the statutory requirements, and that's what's happening when you apply outdated mortality tables, then the member is receiving a benefit in excess of what the contract entitles them to receive. That does not mean that retirees who retire in reliance upon a benefit are forever exposed to the possibility that the PERS board or the PERS staff will come back and say, now we want all the money back. This body has addressed that issue in a statute that both authorizes the PERS board to recoup overpayments and limits the time frame in which they may do so. I think it's 5 years. And after 5 years, then the member's benefit is not subject to recoupment.
Follow-up?
If the legislature were to act to implement new mortality tables on a current basis, what impact would that have on the mortality table aspect of what's come to be called the Lipscomb litigation, which I understand Judge Lipscomb's not very happy about, or vice versa, that is, further events on that issue in that litigation, what impact might that have on legislative enactment?
Mr. Chair, Mr. McPherson, Representative McPherson, in general, my answer to that question will be that actions taken by this body will not affect the legislation except to the extent that it may serve to moot the legislation. And I think that's the case with regard to actuarial tables. My clients, the petitioners in that case, have a judgment that says that the PERS board will implement mortality tables immediately, current mortality tables immediately and fully. And we intend to insist that the letter of that judgment be followed. To the extent that this body enacts a law that does less than that, we will insist on the benefit of our judgment. However, obviously, you could change the law in a way that would make it moot the case on a going forward basis. At the same time, I think if you direct the PERS board, as I believe you should, to implement mortality tables immediately and fully, effective as of some date. The governor's proposal was January 1 of this year. Then the board follows that, then that portion of the Lipscomb decision will probably become moot. And the challenge, if there is one, would be a challenge to the new legislation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have not read all the briefs, as you alluded to, nor am I an attorney, so I could understand a good bit of them, but perhaps not all of them, so I'd like your help. The order that Judge Lipscomb issued, does it direct the PERS board on what mortality tables to implement? Does it say, this is the right answer?
No. And in fact, I think Judge Lipscomb, throughout his opinion, was very careful not to intrude upon the discretionary judgments that this body has entrusted to the PERS board. With regard to the selection of mortality tables, the practice begins by the actuary, Mr. Johnson, proposing the actuarial tables. They actually use not general mortality in the nation or even in Oregon, but they use the mortality based on the demographics of the PERS member group itself.
Mm-hmm.
But the decision as to what tables would be implemented, even under Judge Lipscomb's decision, would rest with the PERS board ultimately.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does Judge Lipscomb's order direct the PERS board on how to deal with the question of look back? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, and Representative Nolan, I don't think that Judge Lipscomb's decision deals with look back at all, except that, in our view, one cannot implement current mortality tables immediately and fully, which is what Judge Lipscomb ordered, if you impose a look back. That, by definition, is something less than fully implementing current mortality tables.
One more follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A while ago, I think about concurrent with the mortality tables that we're currently using back in the late 70s, there was another case, I believe, presided over by Judge Solomon about mortality tables. And so you've got competing orders from the court on mortality tables, or maybe they're not competing, but different orders. As I understand that one, that order said that PERS had to use male mortality tables and couldn't use female mortality tables for the female members, or even a blended mortality table. And I'd like you to draw a thread from that one to the Lipscomb decision, and whether there are conflicts between those in terms of what they tell us about what kinds of actuarial tables we can use and how that is all affected by the contract rights.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nolan, thank you for that question, because the issue of the Solomon decision, and I use that term only to maintain parity with the Lipscomb decision. Actually, the name of the case was Henderson versus the State of Oregon, and that was an issue that I addressed in my written submission and that I had intended to touch upon. Henderson versus the State of Oregon was actually a consent decree entered into by PERS. It was not a judgment in the sense that the Lipscomb decision was a judgment following a contested case. I'm not sure how much significance that has, but it's important to understand that this was a decision that was negotiated between the litigants. And the issue in Henderson really had nothing to do with the question that's before you. At issue was in Henderson was a claim by female PERS members that the PERS board, by using separate mortality tables for women and men, was discriminating against women because, as a group, women live longer than men, and therefore a female PERS member with an identical account balance, identical years of service, identical salary, similarly situated in every respect to a male, would receive a lesser monthly benefit. And just prior to the Henderson decision, the United States Supreme Court, in a fairly celebrated decision, ruled that the use of different mortality tables for men and women was indeed a form of gender discrimination. And so the Henderson discrimination, the Henderson case, like cases similar to it filed around the country, was based on a claim of discrimination. And in that sense, the claim was not focused on what mortality tables were used, but on the fact that different mortality tables should not be used for men and for women. The decision, the consent decree that was ultimately entered, has some language that is somewhat ambiguous, that says, in effect, you shall not produce, use tables for men that are different from the tables that are used for women. I'm not giving you the exact language, and I don't mean to suggest that I'm quoting it. Mr. Hartman reads that to mean, well, that means that we have to use male-only mortality tables for everybody, which is, in fact, what the PERS board has been doing since 1978 for the most part. But in fact, because that case wasn't about what mortality tables you use, but only that women and men should be treated equally, it is our judgment that there is nothing about implementing updated mortality tables that runs afoul in any way with the consent decree. And I am very confident that to the extent that that decree could be read as mandating some use of mortality tables from 1978 today, or using male-only tables as opposed to blended tables, that that decree could be very easily and quickly modified upon an appropriate motion, and that it would not be enforced if somebody attempted to enforce it. I need also to point out there's a fairly long and tortured history that is detailed in Greg Hartman's letter to you about the history of mortality tables from 1978, and I have no major quarrel with the history that he gives you. And in his letter, he points out that sometime in the 80s, and again in either the later 80s or early 90s, the actuary looked at mortality in connection with his adjustment of the assumed earnings rate. It went from 7% to 7.5%, and then it went from 7.5% to 8%. And on two separate occasions, the actuary looked at it and said, you know, I normally would adjust the mortality tables to account for improved mortality, but the effect of increasing the assumed interest rate almost exactly offsets the effect of using outdated mortality tables, and so I'm not going to make any change. We'll just continue to use the same tables, including the same earnings assumptions. The effect of doing that was to, what his conclusion was, that by adjusting the earnings rate and not adjusting the mortality, it produced an accurate blended mortality table. And so since the mid-80s, the PERS board has actually by default been using blended mortality tables. And the mortality tables that the actuary has brought to the board on every occasion since then have been blended as opposed to male-only mortality tables.
And this is my last one, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Gary, did your clients raise the issue of male versus female or blended mortality tables? And did Judge Lipscomb, whether you raised it or not, did he rule on that question?
We did not raise it, and Judge Lipscomb did not address it. The issue of male versus blended was... I'll tell you candidly, the reason that we didn't raise it is because we knew that the mortality tables that were before the PERS board were blended tables, and so it was a non-issue from our standpoint. And it wasn't addressed. The focus of the Lipscomb decision was on whether tables that are inaccurate is consistent with the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Gary. I came out of committee a little late, so I'm shoveling through all this stuff. I'm a little bit lost, to say the least. But I just wondered, on the look-back provision, have you done a written analysis of that and looking at the contract and the tax issues? Has anybody done a written analysis of those things, and if so, can you share that with us?
There is a written analysis that I have submitted to you today that I believe addresses both the contract issue and the Internal Revenue Code issue. It does not specifically address the question of the look back, but our position is immediate and full implementation of mortality tables, which would mean with no look back, does not breach contracts and does not violate Internal Revenue Code provisions.
Thank you.
Bill, you indicated that you didn't expect to see the contractual right issue raised on appeal. What was the argument that was used, and what argument do you expect to see on appeal as it relates to why this shouldn't be implemented immediately and fully?
Well, Mr. Chair, actually, I hope what I said was that they should not be permitted to make the argument. I make it a practice of not predicting what opponents in litigation will argue before they do it. And that's for the reason that I stated. That's a pretty well-settled rule. The argument that was presented in the trial court in defense of the use of the outdated mortality tables was, as the quote that I read from Judge Lipscomb may have suggested, the state's argument was, look, Greg Hartman tells us that he's going to sue us if we update mortality tables, and it's reasonable for us to want to avoid litigation. And furthermore, even if it's not true that the Internal Revenue Code would be violated by updating mortality tables, some people are suggesting that it is, and we have a statutory mandate to keep the PERS system in tax-qualified status. And so, you know, we're just exercising our discretion out of an abundance of caution to avoid litigation and to avoid potential problems with the Internal Revenue Code. The judge rejected those, as I think it was appropriate, essentially saying, now the question isn't whether you're going to get sued, the question is whether you're going to win. And the question isn't whether there is somebody might argue that it violates the Internal Revenue Code, the question is whether it does. And neither of those arguments were ever presented to Judge Lipscomb, the arguments that they did in fact violate the law.
You've mentioned that nothing less than immediate and fully is what you expect based on Judge Lipscomb's decision. To you, does that mean that it needs to be implemented retroactively?
Well, Mr. Chair, the question of retroactive application, and I use that term because you did, I think is a difficult one. I listened, as I'm sure you did, to Governor Kulongoski's position that retirement benefits should not be, that is, retirees' benefits should not be reduced. But in the same remarks, he said, but we need to implement mortality tables effective January 1st. And as I understand it, that would mean that retirement benefits would be effective for people who retired subsequent to January 1 of 2003. The difficulty with not making the implementation date sometime that has already passed is that you encourage a rush to retirement, which poses very significant problems, not only in the sense that for everybody that retires under outdated mortality tables, the costs are fixed, but also as employers, my clients are very concerned about the brain drain that happens if you lose your most experienced and best employees by giving them an incentive to leave. And so whether it's January 1 or some other date, taking a date that has already occurred, I think has a lot of practical appeal. As to whether that presents either a legal or a fairness problem, I've addressed the legal problem. On the question of fairness, you know, if the date is one that is relatively in the recent past, I think it's fair to say that no one that has retired should not be charged with the knowledge that there was a question concerning the calculation of their benefit.
So it isn't your intent then to want to apply mortality tables, new mortality tables, retroactively for the 5-year period to try to recoup
Mr. Chair, I hope that a week from today I'll have an opportunity to talk to you about a bill which I believe will become House Bill 2003 that we've been involved in preparing that addresses the implementation of the Lipscomb ruling, both with respect to mortality tables and with respect to other matters. And I don't want to preempt myself, but let me tell you that the bill includes a mechanism that would pay for the cost of benefits dating back to 1996, which we think is as far back as the litigation permits us to go on the cost side. And it would pay for the additional cost occasioned by the payment of benefits in excess of what the law provided, not by reducing those benefits, not by taking that money out of any member accounts or out of retirees' pockets, but by paying for it out of future earnings. And I'll have more to say about that next week.
Well, sounds like a very good tease, and so I'm sure we'll have a more than full hearing for next Tuesday as well then. Other questions? Representative Barker?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Gary, I hate to put you on the spot here, but I just was curious about if somebody retired January 2nd, we're going to do a go back on it. If it was a firefighter who retired at 55 years of age, $50,000 a year, what would his retirement be if you roll that back?
Well, I can't tell you the answer to that, Representative Barker, for two reasons. Number one, I don't know what that member, what the method was that was used to calculate that member's benefit. And if that member retired on the full formula, then it would have no impact on their benefit, as I understand it, perhaps unless they elected one of the alternative methods of payment, such as survivor spouse. And the second reason I can't tell you is because it requires an arithmetic calculation that I'm not qualified to make. But that information is readily available, at least on an example basis, from Mr. Johnson.
Other questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gary, I realize you indicated that your expertise is not in the area of federal income tax and that you're relying on input from your partner, Wally Miller, who I know from my own work with him is an able practitioner in that area. But we have you before us and not Mr. Miller, so I'm going to test this, your conclusion on the tax code just a little bit. Your statements and the letter you've furnished us refer to Section 411(d)(6) of the Internal Revenue Code and indicate correctly that's a provision that does not apply to governmental plans. Does the analysis that Mr. Miller went through with you, did that engage at all the separate requirement of definitely determinable benefits under the tax code, which is a requirement to which governmental plans are subject? Is that a concept that you're familiar with?
I'm only vaguely familiar with it, Representative McPherson, and I appreciate the fact that I'm the guy at the witness table, but I think I would not be of great assistance to the committee in engaging in much discussion about that, particularly with a person with your own intimate knowledge of those requirements. What I will tell you is that the somewhat general practitioner's, litigator's superficial understanding of it that I developed during the course of the trial led me to understand that the issue, ultimately, to the extent that the Internal Revenue Code will apply at all, is whether there is a change in the benefit formula, change in the plan. And the plan, as I understand it, is the statutes. And in this case, there isn't a change in the plan by immediate implementation of mortality tables because that's what the statutes have always required. And that's about as far as I really feel qualified to go on it, but I'm happy to provide you with additional information from somebody who actually knows what they're talking about on that subject.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Next up, Dan Powell.
I want to thank you, Chairman Knope, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify. I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a lobbyist. I'm here to represent myself. And I'm probably speaking for a lot of members who are under police and fire and who are my age that could have retired in December. A lot of us chose not to retire because of the look back that we heard about. In October of this year, the PERS came out and did a group session for a bunch of us where I work and informed us of the look back. And so we felt like that there was no hurry to retire in December because some of us were working on special projects and we didn't want to leave state service and we loved what we were doing. The actuary equivalency factors were important because we realized they need to change, but we also realized that because of the look back phase that we had more time. And if this committee changes and passes House Bill 2004 with Section 4 intact, then that does not allow us to get out of the system before new actuary tables take place. And it was because of the entrusted board that you entrusted to give us information at a hearing in October that we believed that we would receive the look back, and a lot of us chose to not retire in December. So I'm asking you to remove Section 4 of House Bill 2004 so some of us can retire. I've been with the state for 27 years serving the state and helping keep the citizens and members of the legislature safe. And I don't believe we're asking too much to have that be taken in consideration. We weren't waiting to retire to get more money. Some of us were trying to buy a little more time to finish some of the projects that we're working on. So I'm just asking you to take that in consideration when you make your decision. And I appreciate you giving me an opportunity to share.
Thank you. Questions? I appreciate the fact that you've come forward and you've provided documentation to the fact that this has happened, but you do understand that the look-back provision wasn't necessarily, implemented by them at this point.
I understand that, but they made it implied. The legislature entrusted them, and they made it implied to us that it was. And that's why a lot of us chose to not get out. I mean, obviously, if we knew that that was not going to take place, obviously we would have retired in December. I mean, it's obvious.
Yeah. Don't assume I'm not sympathetic, but I just wanted to understand if you understood that their representation maybe not necessarily was completely accurate, and you understand that it wasn't completely accurate.
Well,
right. I mean, I'm not arguing with you in terms of that you wouldn't retire, because I believe that you would have if you had understood it.
All we were asking from the start was to give us opportune time to make a lifelong decision. And also, currently on the webpage of the PERS, which is a copy I gave you, that section, I think it's a question, I forget what question is, but it's on that sheet I gave you. That currently is on the webpage, talking about the look back. So, I mean, people are pulling that up even as I speak, still assumes that it's still intact, that it is intact. That's the impression that we are getting.
Any other questions? Thank you. I really appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Next up is Velma Hartwig.
Good afternoon, Velma. It's good to see you.
Good afternoon. Great to see you, too. Representative Brown is our representative. I agree with some of the things that have been said, but, you know, you guys made a deal. And many of you are probably business persons, and if you made a deal with your employees that you could retire as of now, for instance, and you were going to get a certain amount, and then you changed your mind after they'd already retired and go back and say, hey, we don't like what you did, so you've got to give us money back. What are those people going to think? And how are they ever going to trust the legislature again? And I realize that the purpose of this bill is to update the mortality tables for the public employees' retirement system. But you must do a lot more than that. The system is irrevocably damaged under the present configuration. The insurance companies are breaking the backs of the public employees as well as PERS with their exorbitant fees. At the same time, it's incumbent upon the legislature to protect the public employees' ability to choose their doctors and other health care providers. At the same time, we must assure that they receive adequate medical care. It's my recommendation, therefore, that the legislative committee consider combining PERS medical coverage as a separate unit with the Oregon Health Plan. One thing that must be guarded against, however, is paying medical care providers too little money. I recently had an experience with Medicare that could have been tragic. My husband slipped on our icy deck and knocked himself out for approximately 5 minutes. I was very concerned and called our doctor. He was not available, and his staff suggested we go to the walk-in clinic in Corvallis. We went to the clinic only to be told that they were not receiving any more Medicare patients. I took my husband to the emergency room at the hospital, which costs a lot more money, where he received excellent care and was diagnosed with a severe concussion. I can only wonder, what if we didn't have a regular doctor? What if I didn't know to take him to the hospital? What would happen if someone with limited funds on a state health plan that paid the same fees as Medicare? It's something to think about. If we're going to do this thing, it would bring a lot of money into the state if the state insured their employees and gave them good medical coverage. It would mean millions of dollars into the state coffers that's now going to the insurance companies, which make huge profits on this. And you're in kind of a tight spot. So any money that could come into the plan that would help provide for the other side of the plan would be of great benefit, because there's a lot of people that are totally dependent upon this who have small incomes and cannot get their own health insurance and so forth. Another suggestion is that we offer all new employees a retirement plan comparable to that of the federal government or private companies. Most of those plans pay 50 to 60% of the employee's last wage. The federal plan is financed in much the same way as PERS, with the employees giving a certain amount in PERS matching funds, and pays an annuity. Now, I don't know how that affects taxes. An annuity is averse to the other plan that PERS has. Many private companies have an excellent system based on IRAs or similar plans. If something drastic isn't done now, people who depend upon the state of Oregon for their retirement will find an empty well when it's time to retire. And I think all of us are concerned about that. I'm not a public retiree. I have an annuity, and I get Social Security. So this is not going to affect me in any way. But, you know, this is something to think about, that maybe combining the insurance with the retirement, because I think that retired employees are still receiving medical benefits, unless I'm mistaken. So this would help with this plan for the retirement. We'd give more money to the state so they could do a better job of funding the retirement system. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks, Thelma. Richard Bianetti. I'm
Richard Leonetti. I'm a researcher with Oregon Tax Research in Portland. I'm handing you a fair-sized packet which kind of summarizes the predicament you find yourself in about PERS, but I only intend to address three items on that front page, period. The gentleman ahead of me, the lawyer, kept talking about immediate implementation of this. Now, the Economic Roundtable in Portland met with Mark Johnson, who is the actuary for PERS, on January 15th, and he answered very directly what immediate implementation is. He said he told the board, the PERS board, that the difference between implementing the first of this year and implementing it the way they are proposing to do a year from now with a look back, that the difference in the cost to the taxpayer was $1.1 billion. Now, that's a substantial sum in the real world. Looked at it another way, I like to put it in terms of every week you dilly-dally before you fix up these tables is costing the taxpayers of Oregon $21 million a week. Now, that's real money. And I think that's why the immediate implementation has to be done. I don't think there's any way around it. The second thing that came to my mind we asked Mr. Johnson about was, is there something bigger than just the tables? Are there more costs buried in any other single item? And there are. There's something that's worth at least two, maybe three times the cost of the table change. And that is the generosity of the legislature back in the 70s. In 1970, there was tremendous inflation. The inflation was running away from these people's pensions. So the legislature instituted, not much, in years when you have 10-15% inflation, but they said, let's raise everybody 2% this year, next year, every year, sort of a post-retirement benefit, if you will. Well, that never went away. It's still with us. And so we did a little calculation, Mark and I, and it's pretty simple to do. It's explained right there for you. But roughly speaking, the employer's cost on an ongoing basis for the 2% is 60%, 50 to 60% more payment for their PERS. 50 to 60%. Now, I don't know what you've assigned to the $1.1 billion as far as the employer's costs go, but I've heard numbers from about 19% to 25%. Well, this is twice as big. This is three times as big, probably. And so I think that's the second thing I'm going to urge you to look at. I know it's not the subject here, but the $1 billion is and the $21 million a week is. Lastly, with all your changes and depends what you end up, I just want to make one simple point about if the possibility is that you want to end this program and start a new one, how might you do that? That's fair. That's, I think, a legitimate question. One way would be to say, all right, we stop the program and we start a new one. Those that are in the program now would have a choice. If they wanted, we would give them cash, roll it into a 401k, and match that payment in cash immediately. Got a $500,000 account, you get $1 million check. And that could be rolled over immediately for those folks. If they didn't like that, they liked the defined benefit, we'd continue the defined benefit. They wouldn't be thrown out of that, no matter what the new program was. Either one of those you could afford. Either one of them are multi-billion dollar choices if you do it over the long period. You and I are not going to pay these things. It's our kids, it's our grandchildren who are going to pay these. So it's kind of important to get it done now, not next week, not 2 months from now, not next year. The dollars, the cash register is running. The clock is running on the amounts of money involved. The rest of it is information you can read at your leisure.
Thank you. Questions? Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it. Don McIntyre?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, gentlemen, and ladies of the committee. My name is Don McIntyre. I'm here nominally as the president of the Taxpayers Association of Oregon. primarily here to emphasize that the work you do is in the interest, has to be in the interest of the people who pay for the government, the taxpayers. Like Mr. Leonetti made a very good case that that you should move with alacrity to keep us from getting further into, deeper into debt, an almost untenable situation. One anecdote, and then I'll make my suggestion. A couple of years ago, we have an activist group that meets once a month, and the guest speaker that meeting, and it was probably over 2 years ago, the fellow's name was Randall Posdana of an economics group called Echo Northwest. They had been hired to do an audit of PERS, and he made, after that audit, he made his presentation to us, and he said, I'm saving the scary part for last. I'm glad you're all sitting down. He said, the shortfall in PERS is so bad that the cost to catch it up, that the obligation of the taxpayers to catch it up, will take the average taxpayer $400 a year for the next 40 years. Now, that was when the deficit was $8 billion. Now I understand it's up to about $15 billion. So, like, as we said, we need to move with alacrity. Unless you do something, the state's bankrupt. The suggestion that I have, and I'm not sophisticated about this, but it occurs to me that one thing that you could do to adopt a new actuarial table is maybe not necessarily use a mortality table, because there is always a time lag. And my suggestion is that you might take a combined average of, say, let's take the top five insurance providers in the state, major companies, and use their annuity tables. Just take five annuity tables every year and update that. At least you stay ahead of the game on that calculation. That is my suggestion. Thanks for hearing me out, and I hope you do move with speed.
Questions? Representative Parker.
And so you would revisit the mortality tables, or whatever we call them, every year, is what you're suggesting.
Yes, and it would be easy to adopt a statute to do that, and it would be kind of automatic. Legislative, fiscal could do that, or whatever department. But you just assemble the data, come up with the average, and that's the number that PERS operates with.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Don. Ed Johnston?
Good afternoon. Stay right, bro. My name is Edward Johnson from Lincoln County, and I do have quite a few deep concerns dealing with PERS, and also too with the Oregon Health Plan that we're looking forward that we have to pay part of as PERS. There's a packet that I've typed up dealing with the suggestion of putting all government employees into the Oregon Health Plan. Locally, in our school district, just in one district, not including local city governments, we are paying $5.2 million per year in medical benefits. Just from the school district. We put that in the Oregon Health Plan to make sure that government employees had the same medical coverage that they are accustomed to at this point now, or to alleviate some of the paperwork that some people would claim dealing with the Oregon Health Plan, they could pay $50 per medical visit, so that way there's less paperwork dealing with the office and the Oregon Health Plan and paperwork. The reason why I'm saying this is that my former position of what I used to do as a mechanic, bodyguard, and professional bouncer, I ended up getting injured on the job. Since my injury, I have gone through numerous non-government programs, because every time I've gone through government programs, I've been told they don't exist for injured workers. I have been fighting dealing with compressed spinal injury of discs in my neck. I have gone through two spinal fusions. I lived 3.5 years with one disc lodged in my spinal cord. Fighting, dealing with the Oregon Health Plan and my insurance company at the time, that if I didn't get the surgery, I was looking at being a quadriplegic or dead. I ended up being forced to go back to work. I ended up with another disc in my spinal cord, which was told to me I shouldn't have gone, but I was forced by the system, not only the insurance company, but by Oregon State law. I ended up with another disc in my spinal cord. I was looking at the same option of being a quadriplegic or dead if that disc would have went in my spinal cord. Both times, and right now I'm still... I'm disability right now, or not, no, get no disability. I'm still fighting workman's comp and the state disability. I'm told I don't get state disability because of PERS and because of administrative pay increases. I've been told that by administrators of the government, of the agencies. Now, I'm frustrated because January 29th, 1999, on the Oregon State Senate floor, I asked for a hearing because I wanted government employees to be elected, for the salaries to be elected by percentage, for the public to be able to have the say in their raises. And that hearing, it came out that the Oregon State is primarily a private corporation, not a government agency. Now, that concerns me, and I was very stunned when that came out because of ruling dealing with Lane County Transit District. I'm dealing with our PERS and program. The one thing that concerns me with Judge Lipscomb is that his opinion does not make much difference to me when it comes to PERS, because I watched him squash dealing with the state of Oregon, forced a five-year-old child into replicating a porno tape of herself for a court case. And he squashed that and would not allow that in the court. So I don't have much respect for Judge Lipscomb and his opinion of anything and PERS. That was 3 years ago when that happened. So, I mean, there's a lot of questions to his questionability of opinion. The one suggestion I have with the Oregon Health Plan, dealing with putting the government employees as a citizen here, just in our district, if we're fitting, just in my county, $15 to $20 million just in medical, just in a county of about 50,000 people, could you imagine what that would be statewide coming back into state coffers? That's realistic. We have to look to the future. If we don't stop right now and do something immediately, we are looking at our grandchildren being in a realistic, not a joke, realistic, in a 75% tax bracket. That's the forecast that we are looking right now, setting our grandchildren into. And we cannot look back because of what's going to happen in the Ford of that position. And their grandchildren, basically, could you imagine if we don't stop now what the reality truly will be? We have to look for the future. I'm so disgusted with the state right now, fighting, dealing with workman's comp and state disability, because I'm told that state disability, I'm not qualified for state disability, even though I can't go to work. I'm looking at possibly going for another spinal fusion to give me a 5% chance of living through this surgery. And this is what we have to look for, our state, and the disabled are the ones who suffer. When I was a bodyguard, I used to protect movie stars, rock and roll, and government legislative people's lives. I literally was giving my life up to protect those. And I'm the one in this chair now looking at a very pitiful life that I can't even enjoy, water skiing, mountain hiking, anything. If I do and I take a wrong step, I'm on one banana peel to a grave. That's the reality. Now, when I paid my private insurance back way back when that happened, my insurance company canceled me. And that was above and beyond what I had when I was disabled, or before I was injured. Because of my injury, they canceled me. Now, this is a frustrating thing that my insurance company last year, when I was injured on the job, I was fired from my job. I was told by the state of Oregon, Bureau of Labor Industry, it's legal to fire a private sector employee from their job. If I was a government employee or a union member, I had rights. I had Family Leave Act rights. But my employer said that when I went in for surgery, I quit my job. So that's all it took. So I lose. Even though that all my doctors and everybody knew I was going in for surgery, I had the deal. I had the time off work scheduled for surgery. But because of that, I lose. That's Oregon State law as today. So when it comes to PERS, I'm very discouraged about the future of this state. The one thing I can proudly claim that I have done in Lincoln County, dealing with part of PERS, part of government spending, is I started in Lincoln County to recall Lincoln County School Board November 22nd. At 8 o'clock, I had one of the happiest moments of my life. We recalled the entire school board. To my understanding, that's the first time in Oregon State history, which I did have help in association with the Oregon State Employees Association, which I'm not a member of, or do I have any association with any union. You know, my family past does. My grandfather started a union in the country and was an AWA member in that. But I don't have no affiliation with unions or anything. I'm here on my own behalf. I was blessed to be here by people who gave me the money to get here. Because I don't have an income. I'm told by the state that, hey, go to your family. Go to your friends. The government aid ain't here to help you. We need our salaries. We need our PERS. We need our benefits. So when you sit there and ask the taxpayers for increases like Measure 28, you wonder why it went down. I was so proud to see that Lincoln County stood up. We definitely want an audit on our school district to know the truth where the money has gone. We have turned in paperwork to State Attorney General's office for that, Secretary of State. Well, I can sort of understand one of the opinions of doing an audit that might find inconclusive of some wrongdoing, because what would that do to the state in the whole? If that happens in one county, that could be a transition throughout the state. I can understand the fear of that. So we're going to sit there and basically not make sure that something happens for the reality of our children's future. We better sit back and create to make sure that they are preserved so they have a future. And the one thing is, if a county can recall an entire school board, which to my understanding is the first time ever done, could you imagine if the people really get upset with the Oregon State legislators? What would really happen? Because I've been getting calls, and I'm open to other ideas that have been asked of me. Because right now, when it comes down to it, I have nothing to lose. You know, I'm looking at possibly another surgery. If I don't live through that, that's life. But that's the life that, you know, God has given to me, and at that point, that's my time. But right now, is that I'm sitting here speaking for the next generation of children, and your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren. So you better sit back and look for their future, not for your present.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next up is Brian Gleshman. Brian, here he is.
Actually, Mr. Chair, we're going to do a little tag team here.
All right.
I brought my firefighter friend with me to protect me.
I was going
to
say, you brought your legal advisor, huh?
Yeah. For the record, I'm Brian DeLashmet. I'm, in this particular case, not going to indicate that I'm speaking on behalf of the PERS Coalition. I'm going to indicate that I'm speaking on behalf of my own clients, and I'll identify those clients. Oregon Nurses Association, Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. You've heard some real impassioned testimony today, but beginning with the legal presentation that was made to you, let me just make a couple of comments. First, I'll say I'm not an attorney, so I listened to the presentation that was made by Mr. Gary, point by point, countering the presentation that was made by Mr. Hartman. The one issue that I would perhaps take exception to, and again, not being an attorney, is whether or not the Lipscomb decision didn't, or had, or should have looked into the issue of contractual rights. It's our understanding that that was not an issue that was before the court by any of the parties. It was not the issue that was brought to the court originally by the plaintiffs, the jurisdictions, that then was consolidated in the one case. So a contention that we should have, or it will be locked out in the future, a discussion about contract rights, at least in my view, is not an accurate portrayal of what the Lipscomb decision, the scope of that decision, and the case was all about. I think that's an independent discussion that may or may not happen in another court setting at the future or future dates. So I guess I just wanted to clarify my understanding of that. Perhaps we can get Greg Hartman to write you a brief, a very brief memo about the issue of contractual rights and play or non-play in the Lipscomb decision. The second thing I wanted to comment about was, and I heard Mr. Theory indicate that the employers were concerned about two things. One, the brain drain, and the rush to the door. And let me indicate to you that the employees, on the employee side, we are concerned about that too. We are seeing a tremendous flow of people to the exits. You've seen the numbers. It concerns us for a couple of reasons. One is that because the uncertainty in PERS, people are making decisions that they may or may not have made in as a rational decision and other times. Let me give you an example. I recently was given an email or sent an email by a nurse at the Oregon Health Science University. Longtime nurse, worked there, very loyal employee, one of their senior staff as far as staff nurses. And she is so petrified by what's been going on, at least the discussions and the way it's being portrayed in the newspapers, that she is obviously exploring taking the earliest potential option for her to retire. It's unfortunate. She's a senior nurse. I do know her personally. Very qualified. Well, in her panic to retire, she has consulted some financial advisors. And the financial advisor that she talked to, the first one, said, "Hers is so screwed up right now that I would suggest to you that you take the double lump sum and get all the way out." Well, I had to explain to her that that may not be a rational approach to take. But those are the kinds of discussions that are going on out there every day. These people are making decisions based upon what they're reading, about what the governor's saying, what the papers are portraying about implementation, times of implementation, which plan is actually going to go forward. You heard the gentleman talk about being about three testifiers ago about being a public safety officer. And the reality of trying to make a logical decision in the environment we're in right now, when the PERS board goes out into hearing and portrays that there's a variety of options, but some of the options include a look back, and then they make their initial determination that they're going to adopt the look back provision with interest accumulation, which you saw them in their presentation earlier on. That's what they plan on adopting in February based upon some legal advice from the Attorney General's office. And at this point, now we're talking about implementation of either a plan, as Mr. Gary suggests, with no look back, and actually having it somewhere behind us so we can't have people running out the door. Well, I would submit to you, one is that's not fair. And I would also submit that some people may have made some different decisions about whether they were or weren't going to retire in the recent past few months, if they'd have had a clearer picture as to what was going to happen. And some other people may have made the exactly opposite decision. They may have moved to retire and not, as this gentleman has suggested, based upon the information. So the message to you, I believe, is one, a retroactive, as it's been called, implementation date is not an option that we're interested in pursuing. We think perhaps the suggestion of that was, in fact, kind of close the door back here so people won't rush to the door. I think that may have potentially created a dynamic, but in essence, what it really did is it panicked people even more. So I think you're going to have an increased rush to the door. Now, on the issue of the actual timing, I think you have really two issues that are in front of you, and I've talked to many of you in the past about this. Really, it depends on which plan you decide on what date you pick. And if you go back to the third special session in which I was in front of the House PERS Committee a number of times, we were at that point suggesting a multi-segmented approach. And I know the employers in the back of the room are going to go, "Here they go again." But let me tell you that if you would have done the multi-segmented approach back in the summer, when we had suggested it as the most legally defensible position, the fairest to the employees, you would have saved more money at that point than you are if you, in fact, select the implementation of the PERS solution, the PERS board solution now. And that was more palatable to us as an employee group than the options that are out there right now. So again, if you balance which plan it is with the timing of the plan, we're still up in the air. I don't know that, other than still saying the multi-segmented was probably the fairest, the easiest transition, we have now moved as a group to PERS board's suggestion of what's called traditionally option D, and you heard a presentation of that, which is you have two parallel lines, the old table and the new table, and that you have the earnings on the interest but not the additional assets being put into the plan until those lines in fact merge, and then you're fully on to the new plan. We have, as a group, discussed that and feel of the options that's on the table, that in fact is the fairest in the land. Perhaps not as fair to us as the multi-segmented, but that's the fairest of the options. If that were the plan, we have discussed the option of moving, potentially legislatively moving that date forward from the January 1, 04, for a couple of reasons. One is we, too, are concerned about cost savings. We understand the earlier you implement a new mortality table, the more you have an opportunity to save dollars. That also saves jobs. It also saves programs we're interested in. So we do. We also have an interest in that. With that, I'll let my... I know I rambled a little bit, but after hearing the presentation you've heard today, I got a little worked up in the back of the room. We've been working on this, obviously, for a number of years and have a substantial interest in it. But I wanted to demonstrate to you the gist of the feelings that the employees themselves are having out there right now, and whether it's a nurse or a police officer or a corrections officer or a parole and probation officer. They are making decisions on whether they're staying and leaving based upon what they're reading in the newspaper, what the governor's saying, and so forth. So I do wish to convey to you that earlier is, as far as an action, obviously is better than later because it stops that panic. But also I would caution you that the decisions you make may in fact have some spin-off effects that cause more people to rush to the door. And I'm not sure that were any of us better off for that. So, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Pat West. I'm the president of the Oregon State Firefighters and here today to represent the Oregon State Firefighters. And the reason for that is because we haven't had time to actually discuss with the PERS Coalition whether we were supposed to represent them. So we're not going to, although I think we probably cover most of their feelings. Brian's done a very good job of kind of capsulizing what we see as the situation. The biggest problem, and when Mark Johnson was here, he talked about the fact that the lion's share, and everybody always talks about the $15 million shortfall, the lion's share of the shortfall is a direct result of the market, meaning the stock market nationally. He talked about specifically the Alaskan system, which is not a hybrid system like ours, and that the employer rates in Alaska, purely because of the market and their investments, were going from $15 of payroll to 30% of payroll, solely because of the market. So when we discuss the shortfall in PERS being $15 billion, that's true in the context of you're taking a snapshot at that point in time that projects it from this point, which is where we are in a reduced market, forward. That's not to say that some of these other issues don't create problems. When you look at the 8% guarantee that you worked on last week and the week before, that we agreed there were some things that need to be done, that alone saved $1 billion. We're very close to it. So we, as employee groups, are working to help do the things to correct the system so that the system stays intact and we have a viable system into the future. But we cannot, nor can anyone in this room, agree to do cuts that make up for what the market did.
And unfortunately, when people talk in the context of $15 billion, that's what they're talking about. If the market, and when the market turns around, which it will, it's a matter of when, then it will change that snapshot. Now, to the issue of the mortality tables, the increase, Brian touched on it, the run to the door is in full force now. There's more people in panic. Obviously, phone calls from people that they're only close acquaintances that know that I'm involved in this, that are up at night sick because they don't know what the future holds for them. I think if you do a implementation of a table that has a look back, now there's various options to look back, but has a look back that at least says from this day forward, your retirement will not be any lower than it was on the day before. You stop the run. You stop the brain drain. The people that are in a panic go, oh, okay, well, if I work another few months, then I don't lose 2% or 4%, or depending on how old you are. And the irony of this is the older, longer workers are the ones that get hit the worst, the ones that are in their 60s. You know, they're the ones that end up with the biggest hit on this actuarial table. So if you do it with a look back, I think that is the best way for you to go forward. It stops the brain drain. It stops people from having to lay awake at night and try and decide to make a life decision today that they really don't want to make yet. But as long as they know their benefit stays at that level and they can work a little while longer, they don't have the panic that they would otherwise. Again, there's multiple options of the look back, but I implore you to use a look back in your process. I think the other side of that is that a immediate implementation of an actuarial table with no look back is the most likely to not withstand legal appeal. We've talked about who has rights, who doesn't. We all have our own opinion, as my dad used to say. Everyone has their own opinion, said the lady as she kissed the cow. You know, so I mean, there's a million opinions on how this is going to work, but the court's the one that will ultimately decide. And if we can do things in such a way that we don't end up going to court, then we're that much better off. So those are the things that I think we needed to touch on, other than what Brian had hit. But I really hope that you will take into account the fact that if you put a look back in, that it slows everybody running to the door.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may just reinforce one point, and it's a point that I've made in front of this committee before and in front of the interim committee. Our goal as the PERS employees' representatives is not only obviously to represent our employees and also make the system sound, but our pledge to you has been that we want to make sure that whatever options are taken, we don't end up in litigation. Because a solution that is drawn up now that gets litigated for 2 or 3 years and then is either overturned or altered, then in fact costs us more money down the road. Whether it's the system itself has additional obligations, or the employees who've been quote unquote overpaid for a period of time, that money needs to be recovered. It costs someone a substantial amount of money down the road. So I guess our continued pledge to you is to work with this committee, with the legislature, to try and come up with something that is as legally defensible from both positions as possible.
And I think that's likely the reason that we expect to get sued from both sides, because I don't see any way that we can avoid litigation on the mortality table issue. I really don't. I mean, I don't think you're going to get agreement from the employers for what you want. Clearly you're not. That was stated today. And likewise, I don't think the legislature is likely to adopt what the PERS board has currently before it. So we're going to, you know, whether the date gets moved up or, you know, what it happens to look like, I can't tell you yet, but I can tell you that I do expect to be sued by both sides. And it, I think it's just a reality that we need to accept, that these decisions are not going to be made solely by the legislature, but by the courts. And until they tell us, you know, who had the contractual rights and where it started, and you know, the going forward, do they have that same contractual rights? I don't think we're going to know the answer to a lot of these questions, but I think it would be dangerous for the legislature to budget based on a decision that's made on, especially on the mortality table issue, because you're right, it could come back and cost everybody plenty.
Mr. Chair, maybe I need to restate my position.
Okay.
As Mr. Gary had indicated, there's a difference between being sued and winning the suit or losing the suit.
Right.
I do expect there to be litigation. If there's not litigation from the two principals, the employers and the employees, individual employees, non-represented employees, management employees and PERS obviously have an interest in this, and as an individual could sue. But I guess the message to you is that we're trying to work to a solution that's the most legally defensible. Not that it won't be challenged, but the most legally defensible.
And I think that's this committee's goal, is to try to work toward legally defensible and fair. I think that's another aspect of it. Now, fair is going to be in the eye of the beholder, and it'll probably depend on whether you're an employee or an employer, but we're going to, you know, we're going to try to do the best job we can in this particular situation. And I see it as a, you know, it's a no-win situation for those of us who are sitting up here, because we've got to make a difficult decision, but we are going to make it. Other questions? No. Nope. Thank you.
Thank you.
J.L. Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Canope and members. For the record, I'm J.R. Wilson, representing NFIB, and I don't want to belabor a tough issue for you, but I did want to lend a private sector perspective to the issue, because from the point of NFIB and the 12,000 employers that I represent, there is a level of urgency ascribed to PERS reform, and particularly House Bill 2004, that's really unlike any issue we've dealt with, possibly with the exception of workers' comp in the early 90s. Now, there's a high level of understanding about how we got into the problem, because I think everyone understands what it's like to get themselves into a fix. But the understanding ends in the private sector when there appears to be a reluctance to adopt remedies, partial or otherwise, that seem well within the reach of the committee, or something that a prudent business would do. And that's the perspective with which we approach the issue, and I want to impress upon the committee that the full and immediate implementation of the mortality tables in House Bill 2004, the business community considers well within reach as a significant cost-saving measure. So I appreciate your taking my testimony. That concludes it. I appreciate the heavy lifting you're doing.
Questions? Thank you. Also entering, we need to enter into the record Jason Williams from Taxpayers Association of Oregon, placed on, I think it was placed on each of our desks, his approach to the mortality table issue and his testimony. So we'll enter that into the record. And last up, we signed up so far, is Jim Boyko. Is Jim still around? He's out in the hall. Mm-hmm. We'll be in recess for a minute or two until we get Jim back in the room. Are we ready? Committee's back from recess. Jim Boyko is in front of us. Jim, before you start your presentation, I do have a couple of questions. And I think you heard the testimony by the gentleman who came forward and talked about the representation on the look back. Can you give us any feedback on that presentation?
Now, Mr. Chair, the representation you're referring to is...
And maybe you didn't get it, but he indicated that he was counseled that there's, you know, the look back is in place and they're going to be protected. And it's on the website. And although there's this is the 57th question that he's referring to, it does in fact say that anyone who retires before January 4th will not be affected by these changes. For all retirees after that date, there will be a look back in the future, and it goes on to talk about that. Clearly that hasn't been adopted completely, I should say. Yet, people may be confused as to what is actually taking place here?
Mr. Chair, there certainly is a substantial amount of confusion. Part of it is due to the fact that this decision is working through multiple venues, as you know, the courts, this body, as well as the PERS board. That FAQ that we have posted is to explain to people what the PERS board's decision was, because they did make a firm policy decision. They have not, and are scheduled to on February 25th, formally enact the draft rule that would put that into OAR. So in the spirit of trying to address many of the same issues that Mr. DeLashmit and Mr. West raised about the fairly massive uncertainty in the membership, we've tried to keep members informed about what the board's policy is, which to date, which up to the time Judge Lipscomb said immediately and fully, was the only operative policy decision on mortality tables we had to report to members. I hope that was responsive.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Continue in regards to your presentation, then.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We appreciate you asking us to come before you. Just for the record, I am Jim Voitko, and I'm the Executive Director of the Public Employees Retirement System. We have, in two particular recommendations, which are public documents to the board, discussed many of the other issues that you've heard from Mr. Gary and Mr. Hartman previously, so I won't deal with those at all. My understanding is you want to focus this question on the administrative aspects of the selection of a date and a methodology for enacting possible legislation with respect to instituting a mortality table change. What I'd like to do, you have two documents in front of you. The first one is a text document. I'm just going to highlight that very briefly, and then I'm going to walk you through what we would recommend from our point of view, or how we would anticipate implementing a decision that had particular characteristics, namely a mid-year implementation date, and a and it would implement also a look back. Which brings me to the summary points of my testimony. First of all, with respect to the date at which a change is made, there are really two issues that affect the administrative feasibility of it. One is when, what the date is, how soon it is in particular. But even more than that, it's how. And we'll talk about that for a moment, because the how really determines more than anything else the speed and simplicity by which we could execute this policy change. I also want to emphasize that we've looked at this issue for the PERS board over the past year and a half, and we've concluded from the staff level that none of these changes are administratively impossible. And we are pledging to do our best, whatever this body or whatever decision-making body directs us to do this, but not all combinations of dates and methods are equal in terms of the ease with which we can do them. And we also have always maintained with our board and with this body that administrative considerations, unless you tell us they're the most important thing, will always take a backseat to your policy objectives. So let me quickly go through the high points of the text. With respect to considerations that your staff said you were interested in hearing from us about regarding a date, we listed six on the first page. Will the implementation date selected cause a waiver of retirements or cause the opportunity for a waiver of retirements? You've heard testimony from previous witnesses on that. It is in full swing. I can tell you that we are approaching now between 3,000 and 4,000 retirements scheduled this year, and we are only entering the first few days of February.
There were 7,000 last year?
There was about 7,000 last year, and at the pace that we're on, we'll break through that quite easily, because the big teacher retirement date is typically in mid-year, and we've not even begun to record retirement applications for that. The real issue with respect to the opportunity or the reality of accelerated retirements is as follows. Do you have a window for people and their liabilities to move it through and into retirement under the old policy or not? If you do have a window, do you make it narrow or do you make it wide? These are exactly the same issues that the PERS board wrestled with in the materials that we previously submitted to the committee. Second issue, will whatever policy you adopt reduce uncertainty or raise it? Part of the problem here is this issue is still moving through multiple venues, but I would agree with Mr. DeLashmit. We certainly, in the calls that we field and emails we field with members every day, there is substantial amounts of uncertainty out there, as well as among my own staff, I would say. How will this affect the funding costs for the system? You've already received actuarial estimates of cost savings from our actuary, Mark Johnson, so I won't deal with that. Fourth is I am pledged to serve our board. And one of the difficult things that they have to do right now is decide how to react or respond to Judge Lipscomb's order. This may be a parochial concern, but it's a concern of mine simply because of my responsibility to support them. Will it create greater or lesser administrative burdens to the system and the fund? And I will go through that in a little more detail in a moment. And lastly, and you've heard from other witnesses, when you pick a policy that you feel is desirable, is it one that you feel is defensible given judicial review? I mean, it is true that hardly a week goes by that litigation in our building is either threatened or discussed or analyzed or pursued. I'm not going to go into the acceleration of retirements except to mention a statistic. We have, by our estimate, about 40,000 members currently of our 197,000 active members who are eligible to retire. And so all I can say is that if there is a window that's big enough and a perceived incentive large enough, there certainly is enough people eligible to jump through it. Whether they choose to do so or not, I can't say. It's hard to read the motivations of members, and you have people who also deal with them that you can consult on that.
So, Jim, you're saying that there's 40,000 people that could retire, and 24,000 have already said that they're going to. So, I mean, you're getting 8 to 10% of those who actually can retire, and we're only 1 month into the year.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Your numbers are on the mark, but even more so, that 40,000 has actually been in place even while we retired 7,000, because there are new people becoming eligible to retire. And one of the things we know with great certainty is the demographics of our membership, and we have about a 10-year supply of people moving into the eligible to retire. In fact, it's more than 10 years. It's more like 15 years. You've often heard the baby boomers, people like myself, are queuing up, if you will. And so that 40,000 gets worked on by retirements, but it also gets fed.
Does that increase then monthly?
Absolutely. With each month that passes, additional people become eligible to retire either by reaching a normal retirement age or by serving 30 and out. With respect to the administrative burden, I did want to pass on the following. I mentioned before that the method of implementation is important as well as the date, and it's really a combination, date and method, that concerns us in terms of planning to execute your policy. Let me give you the simplest thing. The simplest thing, and this is purely from an administrative point of view, it may be unappealing or appealing or unappealing with respect to policy, but the simplest thing is to move to some new modern mortality tables, or I should say modern mortality tables, because our system was built in a way that it accommodates only one set of factors embedded in it one set of tables. It was built that way in the 1980s, and it turns out that, and I think Mark Johnson had mentioned this in previous testimony, we can in relatively short order simply put new factors in. It's not quite effortless, but it's quick, I don't even know that it has it merits a fiscal. From that point forward, things get somewhat more complicated, and then it depends on what types of complications you have. In the text, I've said that if we're required to segment out people's either employment history or pieces of their account balance, that adds another complication. If we do so and are asked to do a look back, which we're prepared to do if so directed, we then also have to do two sets of retirement calculations and then compare the two results to see which one is higher. This is a discussion that we went through the board in some detail. The issue of moving to multiple tables is complicated by the fact that our IT system is incapable of using two sets of factors at the same time. It wasn't built that way. It was hardwired, unfortunately, to use only one set of factors. That can be changed, but not quickly. And not cheaply, but it can be done. And so I want to turn for a moment to talk about the slides that are on the screen to describe what we would do if we had to implement a table, our new tables, with a look back in mid-year. And we've chosen this for a reason, because we know that mid-year is one possibility that the board, that the legislature is looking at, and we know that look back is something that our board has selected and that also the legislature may do. So we're trying to address what we would do if we had to do that. So before you, you see a timeline. On the left, we are between 1103 and 4103. Right now, as you've heard in previous testimony from us and others, we are using the old factors to retire everybody. And we have just retired our first batch, sent to the pension roll and begun payments, our first batch of January 03 retirees. I think there were about 400 of them. And there are more queued up to be sent their first benefit shortly. If we were to have to do a look back, one of the things that's necessary is we need for every active member to know at the same time with great accuracy what is their account value. Currently, we only know that at the end of each year, and it's a long, laborious process. It's very labor-intensive, and it involves reconciliation between PERS and our 857 employers, large and small, to go through every employee who served at any time and earned PERS benefits during that year, their salary and their status, any changes in their status, as well as the whether the correct contributions were made. That happens once a year, and as I say, it's a very laborious process. The committee, we can go into the details of it, but it takes about 3 months. And that's why we issue member statements for the previous year about April or May of the following year. So if we want to do it mid-year, we have to, in essence, do what's in the special box there, in the box there. We have to do a special reconciliation with our employers that says what is the account value with accumulated contributions and earnings for each one of your employees through 4103, but it could be 7103, it could be 10103. We would recommend that it would be on a quarter end if it falls inside the year as opposed to at the ends of the year. But we're not recommending 4-1, we just picked one. You could pick any end of quarter. The at that point, we would have, if once we completed this special reconciliation, we'd have what we needed to do the look-back calculation. Because the look-back calculation, particularly if you use a earn-to-date method that says everything that a member contributed or was sent to their account up to that point counted in the look-back, then we would have the data necessary to do the look-back. The problem is that our system can't actually execute the look-back. So we would have a period from 4103 to possibly somewhere in the middle, put down 7104 of next year, in which we would be reconfiguring the system so that it would automatically do the pension calculation with the new tables and the look-back calculation as of the special reconciliation date with old tables and automatically compare them. The problem is, what do we do between either 4103, 7103, or 10103 to pick those three sample dates and when we have the system ready to do it? And there's two things we can do. We can hire lots and lots of people and have it done manually. The staff has told me about 95% of our transactions would then have to be done manually during that period. The problem with that is it takes 6 months minimum to train a person to do these calculations at some reasonable level of accuracy, and we don't have enough time. So one of the things we've talked about, and I think we would recommend, is that on the date of implementation, regardless of what date you choose, we would begin issuing estimated payments and retiring people on time to get money into their pockets at the time that they said they wanted to retire. And we would do it under the new tables, the modern tables. We would, if there was a look back in place, also notify them that we may owe you some more money, because the look back value might be higher than what we started, what your first payment or two was. The use of estimated checks has a long and not so pretty history at PERS, quite frankly. We do it all the time and have done it pretty substantially in some past makeup work. So we're not breaking new ground here. But the notion would be we would do retirements on an estimated basis using the tables that were likely produce the lower benefit. And then when we got the automated system in place sometime in mid-04, We would then, from that point on, everybody who retired after that would be automatically calculated, and a look back would take place. And we would, in essence, loop back and take all the retirees between the date of implementation, the date that you've asked us to testify on, and the date we could do it in automated fashion. And in essence, redo that calculation a second time. And if the look-back value was higher, then they'd be issued a makeup check, and it would be issued retroactively to the time their first benefit check was done. That's the only way that we think we could cope with a mid-year timing. We'd have to do a special reconciliation, and also a look back, meaning that we'd have to have this period where we'd either have to do it manually or we have to go back and fix the checks, and we'd rather fix them by sending people more money than by potentially overpaying them and have to send them a bill. So that in brief is how we would try to cope with that particular direction if that's the road you sent us down.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boyko. Administrative ease is one thing that you addressed in evaluating some of these different options. Have you evaluated the effect of any of these policy decisions on the likely accuracy of the calculations that you'll do?
Chair Canope, Representative Nolan, we have not done a formal analysis, but I have testified before as to the results of a highly cooperative audit that we had done for us by the Secretary of State's division. They did an excellent job, came in and sampled a very large sample of our benefit transactions calculations, and they concluded that 15% of them have financial errors, which is extremely high for a financial organization. The good news is that the errors tended to be small, but there were plenty of them. There were an additional 15% of transactions that had documentation errors, meaning that the correct documents were not in place, or they were not supervisory signatures were not in place, or there were lost documents. And the conclusion of the audit, and we'd be happy to provide you with a copy, is the main driving factor is the use of, is the dependence on manual calculations to do very complex pension calculations under our somewhat unique system. I hope that was responsive.
It was a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
When you make an error in a calculation, do you handle it differently if the error is an overpayment beyond what the member is entitled to as compared with an underpayment?
Chair Canope, Representative Nolan, we do, although it is a symmetrical treatment. If it's an underpayment, we correct the payment and send them retroactively the amount of money that was lawfully due the member. If we have overpaid a member, periodically I sign accounts receivable letters that go out to retirees that say, we overpaid you and you owe us money back. And we usually, under statute, we have a payment scheme that they can pay us back on, and that it's been delegated to me the authority to stretch that payment scheme in circumstances which warranted, and I do.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it fair to assume that the way you've described how you'd handle this is with implementation immediately and then a catch-up later? If you move immediately to the new mortality tables, whatever they may be, it seems to me, and tell me if I'm correct here, that there is no chance, absent an arithmetic error, if the formulas are properly applied, there's no chance that the look back would result in the original calculation having been an overpayment. It would be a matter only of catching up with the member, the retiree.
Chair Canope, Representative Nolan, that's exactly why we would recommend doing this rather than trying to pull money back. We think it's almost 100%. The only caveat I would say is there are some peculiar situations involving the variable, which depending on how you construct a look back, could result in the circumstance that you suggest. But we think in the main, we would owe people money, and getting more money is usually considered a happier event than getting a bill later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Voitko, I'm reading the screen that's up on the wall now to indicate that it's a 15-month process from an effective date of a transition to a new table set of factors until an automated comparison could be implemented. I'd like maybe a two-part question. One is that a correct understanding? And if it is, then is that 15-month the period that we're likely to see regardless of what the look-back date is?
Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, the answer to your last question is yes. If we don't want to do this a look-back calculation manually forever, there is a period of time, which our staff has estimated actually from 18 to 24 months, to do this. About 2 months has already elapsed, and we've done some work because we've been planning to execute the board's policy. In fact, the legislature has given us authority to spend just a little over $2 million of the trust fund money to prepare for doing a look back. We've spent almost none of it, partly because we haven't been ready to spend it yet, and partly because there's been some uncertainty about whether there'll be a look back, what the fate of the judge's order is, what the board's response might be, or what the legislature might do. But you're correct, it would be at least 15 months, and I would have to say that when my staff saw me put 7104 up there, they were waving me off, and I would argue that is a soft number because we are only at the very beginning of figuring out what we need to do to reconstruct the system to do, in essence, two sets of retirement calculations each time somebody retires, the one with the new tables and the look-back one, and then have them automatically compared. I hope that was responsive.
It is, although I have a follow-up, if I could, which is, if I understood your earlier testimony, there would be, under the proposed transition, a manual comparison for people who went out after the initial look-back date. What would be the typical duration of time before that catch-up payment, if one were owed, would reach the retiree?
It depends on if we were to do it manually, we would try to it's either to fill that gap, Representative McPherson, between the implementation date and the time we become fully automated, with either real-time manual calculations that are one and done, but they'll be slow because they will be manual, so that we would hope that we could keep to the statutory deadline, which is 62 days from the date of retirement to get the first check in a member's hand. Mm-hmm. So that would be what we'd hope to be the maximum lag time. In circumstances like this, we've run right up to that statutory deadline. If we did it the way that is depicted on the board, where we in essence gave people estimated payments that would, based on our illustrative calculations, would be somewhere between, at worst, 88% of their full benefit and maybe 96% of their full benefit, if I recall the examples that we gave to members during rulemaking hearings, then the additional 2 to 12% would be received by the member as soon as we became automated and ran their transaction back through the system and said, gee, we paid you under the old tables $2,000 a month, and we really owe you $2,100, and so we owe you 12 months worth of $100 a month plus interest.
Mr. Chair,
Paul? Make sure I understand. Are you saying that it would not be until the automated system was in place that the catch-up payments would be calculated and paid, rather than there being a manual calculation that's within that 15-month, 18-month, whatever it is, period in which you're setting up the new automated system?
Representative McPherson, your understanding is exactly right. The estimated payment is to try to avoid doing all these manually during that period and instead do them automated fashion. But there is a burden on the member. They have to wait for that increment of their full benefit in most cases until we get the system up and running and see how much we owe them versus, and we only know that by doing the look back calculation.
Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you for your indulgence. Mr. Voico, how often do pension programs normally update their mortality tables?
Chair Canope, Representative Nolan, I've asked Mark Johnson that several times, and he did discuss that somewhat at the committee level. Generally, it's examined every time there's a plan valuation. In our case, statute requires us to look at the predicted number of deaths in our membership in the past valuation versus actual deaths. And if the actuary looks and they're on track, then it's likely that the actuary will say there's no need to adjust our mortality table assumptions. What we're assuming seems to be taking place in our membership exactly as we thought. On the other hand, you could come to the conclusion, as Mark Johnson testified, that as we did in the valuation this fall, we looked and, in fact, people were living longer than the actuary assumed, and he recommended a change. So examining it and changing it are two different things. Changes are indicated typically somewhere in the every 6, 8, 10 year range, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be examined on a much more frequent basis, because you never know when the longevity will begin to make itself known through statistical evidence. If I might also add, a look-back calculation, because of its nature, is something that if you decide to put it into law, could very well be something that we revisit every single time we change tables. So if you want to avoid having to put too many sort of earn-to-date kind of lines in the sand where old mortality tables would apply through look-backs, you don't want to change them too often. You want to change them only when you really need to, when the evidence says that the assumptions you have are incorrect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Michelle Deister. Michelle, we are going to have another hearing on this, so yes. Would you prefer to wait? Okay, we're going to meet again on Thursday. This will be up again. You'll be able to maybe be more lengthy at that time. But we are starting to, I think, reach the final run as it relates to testimony on this. I don't anticipate much more testimony other than on Thursday. And I know amendments are starting to be drafted now, so I would encourage you to make sure you testify on Thursday if you want to get testimony in on this one. Possibly go to work session next week sometime on this, although Tuesday I know the employers are going to present their version of what they'd like to see, which it sounded like included some mortality tables, so we likely will not act before Tuesday next week. So if we did, it would likely be Thursday next week if in fact we act at that time. So just so for your planning purposes. Anything else to come before the committee? If not, the committee is adjourned.